Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Filmcast After Dark, the after show for the Filmcast, where we talk about a variety of random topics that didn't make it into the show. I'm David Chen, here with Devendra Hardwar and Jeff Cannata. This episode brought to you courtesy of the fine folks at patreon.com/filmpodcast.
Thank you!
Thank you very much for your support, folks. We really appreciate it. And today we have a very special treat. We actually are going to just do an entire episode that is an interview slash conversation with a special guest. Our guest today has single-handedly revitalized the Predator franchise, directing the critically acclaimed films Prey and Predator Killer of Killers. His newest film, Predator Badlands, is available now on Disney Plus and Hulu. But all of that is nothing compared to the hardest job he's ever had, being Jeff Cannata's co-host. Please welcome to the podcast, Dan Trachtenberg. Dan, welcome back to the podcast.
Woo! Yeah! Great introduction.
Except for that last part.
I do want to say that we will be spoiling Predator Badlands, which is available right now on Hulu and Disney Plus. Also, there's a 4K out there, if I'm not mistaken, right, Dan?
Yeah, there's a dope Steelbook 4K.
Nice.
And there's, you know, PVOD as well if you don't subscribe to Disney Plus or Hulu. So many ways to access it.
Do you have any say over, like, the Steelbook design and stuff like that? Or
yeah.
Were you like, I want there to be a Best Buy exclusive and a Walmart exclusive and an Amazon exclusive?
I don't choose those, but they present those and they show the art wow. for each one. And me and my producing partner, Ben, are pretty particular. And I would imagine a pain in the butt to a lot of the Disney folks who normally just like... do whatever. And so for the key art for the home video releases, I gave a little input, but I really felt like I got to stop getting too granular. So
it must be hard for them. I was like, oh, you guys care. You care about the presentation of your art.
What is some of the feedback that you would give, Dan, just so, you know, to give people a taste of what it's like to be art directed by Dan Trachtenberg?
I prefer there's a poster design done by Matt Ferguson. That's sort of the layout that feels a little more Drew Struzan-y, and I wanted that to be more prominent and used more often than some of the other key art that I was less excited about. So so some of the additions have that Matt Ferguson poster
Very cool.
on it.
Yeah. Well, welcome to the podcast again, Dan, and obviously very exciting to see that Predator Badlands is out on Hulu and Disney Plus. According to a Disney press release, audiences have streamed more than 300 million hours of the Predator franchise on Disney Plus and Hulu globally. And I assume you are a huge part of that. So congrats on that. Let's talk about Predator Badlands. We all rewatched the movie to prepare to talk to you today. And I have a bunch of questions, but, you know, this can be very free-flowing. Let's start with this. One of my favorite Onion articles has the headline, "Cool glitch effect on movie studio logo must mean shit about to go down," end quote. And I thought about this when I was watching Predator Badlands, just from the beginning, the 20th Century Fox logo.
Mm-hmm.
And you put a little spin on it, didn't you, Dan? You did a little tweak on that logo, did you not? At least audio-wise?
Yeah. So, so starting with Prey, the adventure began with us wanting to mess with the 20th logo. And... the president of 20th being very precious about it, more precious about it than other studios, even though there's been lots of fun riffs on the 20th logo over the years, but he really wanted to keep it classy, and so it took a lot of convincing. And on Prey, we actually made, and it was on it for a long time. Jeff, you may have even seen it with it, where the logo cloaked halfway through, like the theme shuts down and the logo cloaks and laser sighting pops out instead of the spotlights. And then the opening of Prey changed and felt like it was too aggressive for what the opening of Prey was. I then wanted to keep it classy, and the studio approved of it after a long back and forth. And then I like backed out the end. And so every time meaning like for Killers and for Kill of Killers and Badlands, was thinking about, well, I wonder if there is something to do. Had always loved Romulus, kind of brought back the thing that happened in Alien 3, mm-hmm. where there was a long sustain at the end of the 20th theme that I always thought was really haunting and cool and a great tone setter, and thought about, you know, maybe we could do the same just with Yautja dialect, so to speak, and tonality and musicality and all that stuff. So that's where that came from. Do you remember what the Onion headline was? That shortly after a certain film did it, or do you remember what it
was? A trend, I think.
Yeah, it was a trend.
Definitely.
I think.
Certainly. Yeah. I just wonder what
The one that comes to mind is, so let's see. According to moviegoers currently bracing for the next 95 minutes, the cool glitch effect used on the Warner Brothers logo during the film's intro sequence must mean that some serious shit is about to go down.
And it sounds like a Matrix.
I was thinking Matrix too. I'm trying to remember what that.
This was in April of 2018. So I don't
know. I feel like the Snyder movies did some of that, but yeah.
But I agree. Many, many movies have done it. And the Matrix is the one that like most closely comes to mind. Also,
you know,
it's
funny. Yeah.
I was going to say the Harry Potter movies did some wonderful riffs on the Warner Brothers logo.
Did they? I don't remember.
Yeah. Like everyone was kind of different. It got like progressively darker as the movies went on, which I thought was very cool.
I remember Jeff and I's favorite. Do you remember
what is
Jeff?
That?
I don't.
Scott Pilgrim.
Oh yeah. It's so good. Yeah.
Nice.
I mean, every inch of that
is
movie
is a classic as well, but that Scott Pilgrim was great.
We've kind of come full circle, because the cool thing used to be doing tweaks on the logos, and now kind of a cool thing is doing the classic logos that you grew up with,
right,
too. So whenever I see the Orion logo come up these days, I'm like, those were the days.
Oh, like showing the OG. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
I also always loved the MGM when something else would be the lion head, you know?
Mm.
Those were fun.
Yeah. So, Dan, I will tell you, it was a wonderful experience.
We're not even 5 seconds into the movie.
I also love the late title card. The late title card is badass.
Now
I
we're 17 minutes framed. In. All right.
I knew that you were going to figure out a cool way to do the title in the movie. I mean, let's just talk about that Dan.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Yeah.
You obviously wanted to like reveal Predator Badlands in a cool way. Literally, I'm talking about the title appearing on screen.
Yeah.
You know, how much thought was put into that by you? Like, do you have any favorite late title reveals, things of that nature?
That very much happened organically. It wasn't a, we did it. It didn't start as a, I really liked the Prey, the way we unveiled the Prey logo. Let's do it again here. It really just came from that shot and seeing the first cut of the movie and getting to that moment. And then having the realization like, oh, what a perfect, especially at the time he was in front of a really cheesy template that we had. So it was like, how could this be better for while we watch it, you know? And oh, the logo could go, oh my gosh, let's readjust. So we're in more sky than landscape. So it can feel, cause the Prey logo was in the sky. And so it just really came from the moment. My favorite, I don't have the best recall, but I remember there was the show my wife loved, and I only really watched a couple, but I remember the pilot or the first episode. Oh shoot, guys, it was I think it was Britt Marling and her team, the OA.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure the first episode, like the end, it's like the end of the episode, it like shows a main credit.
Yeah.
And I tried to do that on The Boys. Did we end up doing it? No, because of there's DGA. I wrote a letter, and I think Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg wrote something to try to get it to happen, and
to put The Boys title.
We
at the
wanted
end
it.
Of
we
the
had
episode,
a whole thing,
right.
And we used The Boys Are Back in Town music that also we couldn't afford. Right. But like, it was really, for a long time, we like lived with the cut that way. Mm. And it was so cool that it was like, the, you watch the whole first episode and then it's like, and this is the main title. And there was a post credits. That's what it was. Cause then we went, we put a la Marvel. We had on the pilot episode of the show, a post credit scene. And I thought, what a cool gimmick for the rest of the series. Like, you have a post credit scene for every episode. Anyway. But I remember the OA being really delayed. Are there, do you guys have recall on other delayed?
I feel like Abrams does it a lot. Like Lost did it sometimes. I mean, Alias Avatar. Did it quite a bit. Avatar. For sure.
What was, what was Avatar's?
Avatar's like the last shot of the movie. Is
oh yeah,
Avatar.
Oh. I'm gonna say, have you seen?
But
the...
that's different. I'll just point out, like, that's
an ending card.
Yeah, we had that too for Badlands, which in us was Lion King. It's always the. We got to do the Lion King thing, you know, like we.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to think if there's one that's like 50 minutes into the movie, like, you know.
I mean, I want to say Drive My Car, the Ryusuke Hamaguchi movie. Mm. That one is like an hour or like 90 minutes into the movie.
They had time to like, burn. They had like 3.5 hours.
That was
to burn
an incredible. I was like, holy shit, when that
really?
Comes up.
That's cool.
Maybe it was like 30 minutes. I don't remember. It was
a while.
Some significant amount of time into the movie.
Does it a lot of video games. Video games do it all the time where it's like you play 20
you'll
minutes.
Play like a tutorial or something. Yeah. And then.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
That may have even been the more subconscious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does feel like the tutorial is over and here's bad. You know, you've come to the planet and yeah, that's funny.
Drive My Car was 40 minutes in, by the way. I made a note of it at the time. I still have my
it just feels so clutch when you do that. It feels you are in full command of this narrative.
That's confidence. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the stuff we see before that, I think, is, you know, a lot of the Yautja planet and the fight between brothers. And I'm curious. I don't think you and I have ever really talked about this. The fight between brothers. Did it evolve in different ways? Did you guys have a lot of discussions about what that ritual should be or what the location should be? Because it's. You know, it's a pretty extreme fight in a pretty extreme location, and of course, that's what you want if you're predators, I guess. But did you have other versions of how those two brothers or where they were fighting or the sort of details of their showdown with each other?
That's a great question. I'm trying to remember if the different versions would only have been in like the original drafts.
Yeah.
It may have just been like, in fact, there was a, well, that was for the, when they're fighting dad. It may have just been out in the open at some point and then it became a cave fairly quickly. I would say it became a cave, but, and they were on an island, a cave at one point, like this secret island. And I remember really stressing about cave because no matter what, it's a really tricky setting in movies because a fake cave looks like a real cave and a real cave looks like a fake cave, you know. Even when I'm in a real cave, like if we perfectly recreate and we went to some caves in New Zealand and it feels like it could be made from styrofoam, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It all looks like a set. So.
Take that, nature.
So we really tried to find a way to make it feel a little bit more expansive and unique. So the scale of it, it wouldn't just feel like this a claustrophobic set. And I was pretty hell-bent on there being not just waving swords in a dark place, but like using the environment and wanting to go vertical. And there was a lot of figuring out of how we could afford to do that. And even I think people had a hard time envisioning choreography, up in the stalactites, you know, people had a hard time being like, but how do they hold their swords if they're holding on? Like, it was hard. It was,
why does Dan keep saying up in the stalactites? He's a madman.
And that was one that like we had prevised a bunch of things and we couldn't previs that. So like previs would have been able to show people. Eventually we did, or actually it was post-viz. But so it took a long time to figure that out. And a large part of it was figured out towards the very end of the process.
There is a scene early on in the film when Deck has arrived on the planet Genna, and he kind of lays out all of his tools, right? He kind of puts all his tools out there, all the badass Predator weapons.
Yeah, inventory check. Yeah.
And then he loses access to all of it because he gets chased away by the plant thingies. I just want to say, to me, that scene felt like a metaphor for you making this film. And what I mean by that is, there were so many things that would have made your life easier to make a movie. Having the character speak in English, you know, using a human actor as the protagonist, right? Like that, you know, and like all these other things. And it felt like
this, it was a human actor.
Yeah, no, I know. But like, you know what I'm saying? Like a human
poor
character.
Demetrius. Yeah.
Human character. You know what I'm saying? You know, like things that like would make the movie more marketable or like that would be easy, you know, not requiring a visual effect shot for like every time the main character needed to talk, which is what it looks like. Right. Did you feel like you were purposefully trying to make things like purposefully challenging yourself in order to kind of make this film, or was it just the specific story you wanted to tell or some combination of the two?
It's probably rooted in the same thing. Definitely that narrative moment was because I wanted people to root. I wanted all of us to root for the monster. And it's much more exciting to watch someone try. That's why the mission movies are at their at their heights, when we're seeing the team or Tom specifically like try. And I wanted to just surprise, of course, and there's an expectation for the Predator to have all these fun gadgets and how fun it would be to when you see them taken. All of us, there's like a disappointment. Like the audience feels a lot like Deck in that moment, because Predator fans feel like Deck, because you see that bow and you see the go, oh yeah, I love all the gadgets, and then it's all taken away. You're like, oh no, I don't get to see those things, you know. And Deck,
you mean
is
the
also
purest
like,
Predator movie and Predator story, basically.
Yeah. Yes. And they're definitely the whole thing came from oh my gosh, I've never seen this. I want to see this. But part of it is certainly like part of why we haven't seen it is because it is so hard. And I don't think I realized how hard it all would be. I think in my mind, some of the ideas came from what I thought would make things easier, weirdly.
Like what?
Like giving him a companion. You know, I was like, I can't just be him. We got to get inside of him, and he's not going to be talking that much, and so we need to give him a buddy. But I didn't want to be a human buddy, so I thought I'd be robot. You know, like oh, then I was like, okay, what's a non-human thing, but not. It can't be another CG character. It's got to be human. You know, okay, robot synth. Oh my god! And then she's broken, and you know all those things,
right?
And I remember pitching to the studio, like, what I think we'll do is we'll have Thea wear a Deck backpack so we can shoot everything up here. And like, he's just this animatronic that we build, and she can be walking around. And like, I had these stupid ideas that it all ends up being like very expensive. But that idea that I thought would make the movie easier to make and shooting in nature and all those things that are like, this is, you know, we don't have to build sets, but all of it actually is so much more challenging to do. And there's not, it's both the thing that makes a certain part of the audience averse and keeping keeps the movie at arm's length of like, I don't know if I'm going to like you with all these things in it. But it's also the thing that is, when you do come to it and you lower your guard, it's the things that make the movie great, hopefully, you know.
Yeah. Are there any decisions along those lines that you're like, oh, I deeply regret that decision? You know, because you're saying you made a bunch of decisions to try to make it easier. It actually made it harder. Is there anything you're like, oh, man, shouldn't have done that? You know, anything along those lines?
I mean, just stuff that we somewhat course corrected along the way. If you buy the disc, there's a bunch of deleted scenes and a whole bunch of previs, a ginormous amount of previs. And we, the first thought was maybe they're all L Fannings, you know, every model is the same. And then that became, well, Thea and Tess are special. And then everything else is one uniform drone synth. Be a little bit more haunting and special and unique and cool. And it narratively made sense. They just send this sort of crash test dummy model, this militarized model there on a new planet with a specialist like Thea and Tessa. But that was, while we were in prep, seemed to be too expensive. And so then we concocted this idea of maybe there's like officer synths, and then there's the drone, and then there's, so we could not have to do a duplication effect as much. And we shot the Tessa storyline was one where she was demeaned by the officer and trying to rise up and overthrow him and become, and so that was what we shot first time around. And it was definitely a mistake. it was a mistake narratively because, one, we were not that intimidated by Tessa. We were kind of rooting for her, and the villain of the story took a long time to reveal itself and to be felt. It was hard to feel it. And also it was too quick to show, we didn't have enough cutbacks to even be invested in her overthrow to then become the villain.
I see. So Tessa had this whole other subplot where she was like rising up the ranks the whole time.
Correct.
Instead of in the film, she's completely like annihilated and then she needs to be like revived.
Correct.
In the pod. Yeah. Interesting. So you shot all that and then you decided to scrap it.
Yeah, there's a deleted scene on the disc that has that with her up against some officer synths. And then that also, which was my fear at the time, but we couldn't afford to. But the officer synths, it just, you didn't know they were synths. They're just like, yeah, that's, I've seen movies where there's a bunch of henchmen that all look different and they hold guns. And I'm sure I've said to you guys, but like a thing that's a North Star for me is always like, what can happen in only this movie, you know?
Yeah.
That was us not obeying that rule. That was like, I've seen this in lots of movies, and the thing that can happen in only this movie is the, what if they send only this one model? Because they're robots, so we might as well take advantage of, well, what does that mean? If that means they wouldn't bother to change features, and they, you know. Yeah. So we eventually got to the right decision, but we definitely lived in the wrong decision for an insane amount of time.
Wow. Interesting.
But it was cheaper towards the end of the process in some respects, not in every respect, but some respects, once we had our cut and we knew exactly how many shots there were. And I just had to write some upsetting, painful letters to people to say, you're
out of the movie.
That's right. You're out of the movie. That's
right. Yeah, it was just a bummer.
I do want to talk about Tessa at the theater.
It sounds like you at least wrote, like, sometimes people do not even get that courtesy. So, at least you did that part. Anyway.
Yeah.
It's happened so many times. But
yeah.
Do you want to talk about Elle Fanning? Because I've always liked Elle Fanning. Like, we've seen her grow up in many films. This feels like such a distinct, multiple distinct performances for her. How did you land on her as being the person to embody these characters? And were there other people like that were bringing other things to this role that you were considering too?
The thing I was on at the time was, for my lack of imagination, funny, witty British. Okay. I was looking for the female.
Oh, hard to find those.
Yeah. I was looking for the female Simon Pegg. And I'm sure a lot of people are coming to mind right now for all you guys. And that was my first instinct. And because of that, I watched. And some actors, we were seeing a lot of actresses, a lot. And some people would come in and do British if they weren't. Many Brits saw Brits, but some people would come in, do British, and some people would just do in their own accent. I still was sort of like, I don't know about the American thing.
It could have been Philomena Kunk. Could have had Kunk here.
And so I watched, and all of it is because of C-3PO and Stephen Merchant in Portal and and probably many other things. But female side, it was like I was almost like, I wish it could be. Imagine Simon Pegg strapped to the back of the yacht. Like, that would have been so fun. But
by the way, the female Simon Pegg, you know, is Peppa Pegg.
Wow.
Jeff just.
Damn, dude.
Wait, how am I waiting? When will Dan stop talking so I can say? It's actually shocking they haven't. There must be someone must have done a Simon Pegg is Peppa something.
I don't think they've had a lot of guest stars, not him yet. I bet.
But so then I because of this, I watched The Great.
Yeah.
I thought of Elle. You know, I think, look, big fan of her. She was actually in, there's a show that we champion on TRS called The Lost Room.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah.
She was at her youngest. That may have been her first thing ever.
Oh, really?
Other than she, I think she did the voice of a Totoro. But we loved her in Super 8 for all the reasons that most people and a lot of filmmakers fell in love with her doing a performance as a kid actor doing a scene that blows people away emotionally. A pretend scene in a kid's movie and then becomes just her as kid again, who's also incredible and like almost doing a dual performance.
Yeah. She does something very similar in Sentimental Value too, by the way, you know,
very
where she plays
very
an actor
similar,
in
very
that
similar.
Film. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So there was something in my mind about her with that. And then, but funny, I wasn't quite sure. And The Great had both the British thing and funny and also very intense. And then I started watching interviews with her and she's so sweet natured. And that it was only then, and she has a slight Southern thing. I think she's from Georgia, Devendra. And then I thought, oh, maybe it is cool to not be British, to just be elephant, to be
non-British people can be funny.
You know, like maybe that's a funny counter. Well, I just thought the an intelligent British a monster is, you know, that's funny. Yeah. You know, so like this was the other thing that was a really stark contrast is Elle Fanning, you know, on a monster. But when we first met, we were still debating between British and not, you know, and it wasn't until hanging for a little bit more where it became like, let's just do you.
That's cool.
Love but that. Yeah, that's how I arrived.
It's funny. There's a whole scene in Sentimental Value where she's like talking about doing an accent or not.
Yeah,
doing
an
accent.
Yeah.
Funny.
And she and Sentimental Value, that was we had to figure out our schedule so that she could get there and she
BRB, I have to do an Oscar role.
I know.
Well, it felt, in between this movie.
It felt like it could be that. So it felt like we really should try to accommodate, you know? and there was she came to us right after rehearsing in Norway, and then our last day of shooting, she got on a plane and like the day, like we wrapped her, and then we shot a couple more things.
So she had Predator in her mind during Sentimental Valley.
Wow. Yeah.
Probably
you can see it. You can see it if you really look closely.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. On that note, Dan, how aware of you, like I loved all the Weyland Yutani stuff in the film, and the, you know, we're seeing like a reimagining of all the Weyland Yutani technology in Predator Badlands. how aware of you were you of other stuff going on in like the alien universe? Did you see Alien Earth? Obviously, you've seen Alien Romulus, but like, was it important to you to kind of fit this into the other stuff that was going on in the pop culture at the time for Weyland Yutani, or were you just kind of doing your own thing?
It was, but I couldn't see anything. Alien Earth, or sorry, Romulus, we saw as a crew. Mm-hmm. We midway through production,
wow.
Or if not later. And I mean, I'd gotten a couple, I'm friends with Fede, and yeah. Obviously the studio would send me like screen grabs of things, but not really. And mentally I was like, we're far in the future. I was just trying to be right. Like, so no matter what, like no one can be upset. But of course we saw it, and then we took the eye gag from Romulus where his eye spins in the back.
Yes.
Yes. We really used the crap out of that.
Which is that's idea. Kind of like a unifying visual concept is the robot eyes and how they look when they're shut off, right?
Yeah, invented by Fede. It wasn't in any of the previous alien stuff, and it was just such a genius thing. So
leave it up to him to give like the creepiest way showing that too.
Totally.
That's why I love him. It's
brilliant. Yeah.
And Alien Earth also was only mildly aware of and during production, and it wasn't until we were deep in post that Noah Hawley actually reached out. He wasn't aware of us till our trailer came out and was like, whoa, there's
hey, we're playing the same universe, we should talk. Yeah.
And so he reached out and sent me some episodes to watch, and thankfully, you know, we all ended up doing very different
nothing
things.
Conflicted as far as I could tell.
Thank God. Yeah, it could have. It all could have. I mean, I didn't think I knowing the time that everything was set. The only thing I was a little bit concerned with was if he might end up doing something with a power loader, you know?
Mm. Yeah. It was weird when Elle Fanning said, it's time for me to go back to Earth where no aliens have ever been before. That was strange. And it felt kind of like a direct shot at that show, but you know, I'm not the one directing the film. Anyway, Elle Fanning, as a backpack, watching the movie, my experience watching the film was, I bet Dan used a bunch of different things to pull this off. Yeah. Like, it wasn't just one thing. That's my guess, right? So can you share a little bit about the many different things you used to pull this off?
I got to tell you, there were lots of laughs over my dead seriousness when I found on Instagram, this guy has invented, I wonder what's up with this. Is this still, but this guy invented, he's a backpacker. Maybe you see these in Colorado, Jeff. I don't know. Yeah. But he's a backpacker, and he invented this balloon system that it's like tethered to the backpack to serious backpacking.
That's
like a lot of weight.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. Yeah. And I was like, let's do this, guys. Maybe that's like the way. And my AD was like, you know, we're walking through the woods with a lot of sharp trees. Like, I don't know that that's going to
work.
As
opposed to this other backpacking guy who's not in the woods?
I know. That's what I said, Jeff. Yeah.
And that was Dan's seventh AD that he had went through.
I guess you're also fired.
Yeah. I can imagine the like old grizzled the effects guys who've been through like dozens of movies being like, he wants a balloon backpack?
Yeah.
Really?
The special effects
guys. That's what we're doing? Yeah.
It's really a combination of brilliant AD and awesome stunt coordinator who has this crazy dual role of having to come up with awesome fight sequences and the practical nature of pulling off those fight sequences, as well as this unprecedented, you know, stuff with the rigs for L. He's our stunt coordinator, Jacob Tomori, was Tom Hardy's stunt double forever. He was he was Tom's double on Fury Road and then was a coordinator on Furiosa.
Wow.
And was a part of incredible, you know, you've seen incredible death-defying things that are all very rig based, you know? So we were blessed to have him on the
That's
movie.
That's super cool. So he's worked on some of the best movies ever made, and you're coming to him with a balloon backpack. Amazing. Amazing.
Exactly. Did you use any balloon packs on Fury Road?
So how would you describe kind of like the main way that you did it? It sounds like there's like
the
a main way.
The ways were wire rigs, challenging because we were in nature, so they had lots of things strapped to trees, and we had to find trees and go in the day before and set up rigs, and we had to kind of choose our path and stick to those paths. And that was one system. And then there was another system where it was a wheelbarrow, and he was it was sort of strapped to his waist. Her legs could just be in the barrel,
right?
And the that allowed us to make turns. So the wire rig could just be a straight line. The other, and sometimes if it was just simple up and down, then it was more people suspended. It wasn't a whole line system. But then the wheelbarrow was great because we could turn, but it really affected his gait, and you could kind of feel him like pulling against something. He did his best, and there's moments in the movie. The one that's the most that is when they're in the Kalisk den before the big fight with the Kalisk, and they're looking around, and she finds her legs in the it's a brief moment, but that's that sequence was all done with the wheelbarrow. And then, you know, crazy enough, Elle one day when we were shooting the fire, the hanging out by the fire pit scene the next morning was him having to pick her up and put him on his back, and then they head out, and I needed several shots to articulate the lifting up, and Elle had witnessed me multiple times trying to figure out how to do things practically. We had a miniature unit that we were trying to figure out if we could do any miniature stuff, and she was like, I think I can just
throw me up there, Chief.
Like, do it with my body. Like, I think I could just, like, act, you know?
I actually do have legs.
Yeah.
Yes.
And and so they did, it's, I think it's one of the best effects in the movie. She just, like, found a way to make her body feel dead. And he lifts her up. It's all her miming it. And then they're standing back to back. And they synchronize their walking off. Mm-hmm. And from then on, which was unfortunately for Demetrius and Elle, the last like week of shooting. But from then on, we did that as much as possible. Just them kind of standing back to back and walking back to back. And Elle just being a great actress.
It's funny how much pain and suffering can be traced to the thing you wrote in the script. You didn't have to take her legs away. She could have had like a one leg. It could have been, you know, something else. But you made it the hardest for yourself.
We
amazing.
Did.
Yeah.
We did.
How important it would make was it that? Easy, like,
but, yeah.
At some point, did you ever think to yourself, maybe she should just have legs in the movie? You know, like, did that ever cross your mind at all? Like,
it's just not fun.
And I'm saying just for like, not for story perspective, just like for practical purposes to make your life easier. Did that
what actually was hard was what I did think of very early when I started like sitting with the script with my DP and thinking about what our coverage of certain scenes would be. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh God, this is just giving me the same thing over. She just, it just goes over her and her back and hit like, and I guess they're just walking, you know, like there's, there's no dynamicism to any scene because they're just tethered. So really it was trying to figure out, that's why there's a scene by a waterfall. Mm. And it's as if he set her down, and that's why he looks at a tooth and says, is this the, it was just trying to figure out how to make this conversation more dynamic and lived in and not the same thing. Just, they're just walking and she's on the back.
Well, there's a whole montage after he picks her up, where you kind of, you shoot her from like vastly different angles, and like there's an overhead shot and it's a far away like wide shot. And, you know,
that's before the backpack.
I see. I see. Gotcha.
Yeah. That was the before.
Is there an official name for the L backpack? Because I would call it the L fanny pack.
Yeah.
There you go.
That was a joke that was said sometimes. There was a lot of like, I got your back, and all, you know, she actually, her crew gift at the end of the production was jackets for everyone that said, I've got your backs, you know, Elle Fanning, which is great.
That's nice.
Yeah, that's actually that sequence that you're bringing up, that montage was a whole new set of rigs. Everything was a different, the football carry, the suitcase carry, like everything required vastly different rigs. And we were in dangerous places, you know, so it was also safety rigs.
Yeah. Those shots are so great. Like, I'm rewatching Fellowship of the Ring with my kids right now. Uh-huh. I'm like,
I did this.
Man, we used to shoot movies out in the open. No volume, no like, no stage sets. Just like, it's out there in nature. And this movie really got that vibe. Yeah.
Same. The hard thing was like, how do we not be where Fellowship was? And one the location where he
used all of New Zealand.
He did a lot of New Zealand. The location in Badlands when he drops her and then he chops up all the vines and then turns her into the backpack, that specific place is like 2 inches away from a location in The Hobbit.
Oh wow.
Where Frodo pulls out Sting or something. There's this very specific, he's underneath the rock. That every time I walked by it, walking to our set, I'd walk by and be like, remember the, you know, the scene.
You know, a lot of the questions you've been asking, Dave, are, you know, about why didn't you make it easier for yourself? I got to say, one of the things, the thing I admire most about you, Dan, as a filmmaker is, and as a person, is how you are committed to the best version of something. And you will, you know, having had conversations with you when you're, you know, thinking about different projects to take on or not take on, you will, as you said, you know, what's unique to our movie, what can only be in our movie. I so admire your ability to not take the easy route or not always challenge yourself and always do the thing that is going to bring something new to the table that somebody else isn't doing. And it's an amazing quality, and it's something that I think makes these movies so great, is that you are challenging yourself. You are constantly not taking the easy route with your art, and it's amazing.
Thank you. It's kind of a dirty secret, I think, that like, I think there's a lot of people that have better constitutions than me and better endurance and dexterity than me, and they're just has to be a decision to aim for a thing. Like, all you have to do is, there's a lot of movies or any medium that just aren't decide at some point not to even aim for that. And then that means when everyone's excelling and being the best at their jobs, they're just hitting a ceiling. They're doing the best, but this is all that the idea wanted it to be. You know, this is all that it was trying for. And all you have to do is just aim for that other thing.
It's not all you have to do.
Well, but then everyone is just building the ladder to that rung, you know, like I don't know. There's so many things come like my way, or even ideas of my own that I'll be thinking about for a while. And I'm like, oh, but the best version of that can only be that, you know, like I just got to keep going, you know, keep trying to figure out what is the thing that where the best version of it could be this other thing, you know,
because it's easy to forget with how good Badlands came out, what a risk it is. You know, and Prey as well. Prey was a risk, but I think even a bigger bite from the apple, like, you know, like Dave was outlining in the intro, you know, you have a main character who A, has been the villain up until this point in the franchise, and B, is hard to relate to because his face looks weird and his language is weird and everything is, you know, it's a massive risk to take on, and that's the kind of thing that you gravitate toward, and it's amazing. You could have done a lot of easier things to make a buck, and you're not ever going to take that path, which is impressive.
Thank you for saying.
The other thing that, you know, I'm privileged to have seen the movie in an unfinished state, and the other thing that I came away from that experience marveling at with you and your skill level as a director is, you know, when I saw the movie early, there were a lot of issues with it. There were significant things that you knew weren't done and weren't ready. And not just from a visual effects level, but like, you know, the movie didn't work the way it now works, right? It wasn't polished. Yeah. And I came away with that from the, and we, you know, a lot of people were giving notes and a lot of those notes were really great. And I was so impressed with how you knew the things that were fixable, you know, and there are such small, and having seen the movie, you know, like I said, in that early state compared to its final state, often the things that fixed it, those issues weren't big things, weren't major changes. They're small things, a line here, a little edit there, a new shot here or there. And I'm curious, I find that so incredible, frankly, mm-hmm. that you can find those and you can look at a work that you are crafting and understand how to make those fine adjustments. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that, ability.
It is the thing that is, I bring this up on every production, but it is the thing that is simultaneously absolutely terrifying and also fills with hope, which is just how delicate a movie is. That, mm-hmm. you know, one shot, one frame, you know, 15 frames of a thing can make some people laugh at something or make people go, that was dumb, and not laugh at all, you know, or like care about someone, not care about someone. It is so delicate. And we spend so much time in post, you know, talking about big swing of like, what if we did this? What if we did all these changes? And sometimes the feeling for all those changes is right, but actually you just need to change one little thing and it will make it feel like that. I'll use something from Cloverfield Lane as an example. Maybe I've used it on the show before, but I'm sure none of us remember anyway. But there's a scene in that movie where Mary Winstead and John Goodman and Gal Gadot, the three characters are sitting at a dinner table. And she's doing this very specific thing where he had said, the John Goodman character in the beginning of the movie said no touching. And she's trying to get the keys off of his waist and she's going to use, his anxiety and frustration, over his rules to get him to come close to her so she can take the keys. And we had a cut of the movie that it was not quite doing it. And people were confused, like, how does she pull off that thing? Whatever. And my editor, Stefan, had this brilliant idea of like, I just need a close up of their fingers touching when they pass the pepper, you know, when they pass mm-hmm. the thing. I just need to get a they were doing that. It was in a two shot. And like, you could see that, but right. I just need to like the camera to exaggerate, yeah. like they've touched. And then I need John Goodman, his hands doing this out of nervousness. And when we reshot the movie, Goodman was not available. So we got our camera operator. We looked around the room like whose hands looked the most like John
Goodman hands. I need Goodman hands.
And people were like, they were like simultaneous like excitement and dread of like, do I have those hands? And our camera operator, Kale, had those hands. And so we shot an in tight insert of his hands and that fixed the scene. The scene that was broken, that wasn't working, it was too long, so we were going to have to cut. Mm-hmm. All those things, like, just too close, not rewriting it, not reshooting the whole thing, two close-ups. That is like such a like, oh my God, we can fix any problem in a movie. You know, whenever there's this thing, like we can do it, but also you can ruin it. Like, oh my God, if we didn't have those two shots, the scene right. is ruined. And we, you know, like it's so, and when you get notes and you're like, I don't know. And sometimes they're helpful. And sometimes it's like, oh my God, even if that person may think this is just a small thing. Can't you just put my idea in the movie? You know, like, but that small thing can totally affect the read of something and the rhythm of something, and you know, and it from working or not working and being great or not great. So, it's on my what you're bringing up, Jeff, is on my mind a lot. And it's, and once again, it's like the thing that makes me realize when we're getting those notes, when we show the movie early on, like I we can find a path here to address these things, and it might not have to be a big deal. Even when we're to the bitter end, we can make small changes to make the movie great. But it's also like, oh dear Lord, we could ruin, you know, we could ruin something.
I like the idea of that divorced from the actual task, the request you're making just sound like the request of a madman. Like, I need John Goodman hands, and they're going to be hanging from stalactites, and we need this rig from the trees to have L. Fanny's legs in them.
Let's go. Like,
you just described the caricature of a director in a lot of like shows and movies, like Entourage. Yeah. Like, that's what the director's running around saying.
All right, Dan, I want to ask you about the decision to make this movie PG-13, if it even was a decision in your mind, right? So there's some mild controversy around this, right? Because Predator movies in general, hard R, man, you know? And this movie, I think, is wonderful because it actually, I shared this with you when the movie came out. My wife's best friend took her two teenage sons to go see the film, and they had a wonderful time. And it's like, it's like welcoming in a whole new generation of people into this franchise that would not otherwise have access to it.
Yeah.
And that's delightful, but also obviously very different than what's come before. So like, how much was that on your mind as you were making this film? Of like, were you shooting for PG-13? Did it just happen to be that way? Or, you know, like, can you talk a little bit about the movie's rating?
Consciously and subconsciously. So consciously, I wasn't, you know, consciously everything kind of came out of all the cool narrative ideas. Subconsciously, when we were wrapping up Prey, when I was getting towards the end and I was feeling proud of the movie, I remember thinking, can I be the first director ever to try and make a director's cut that's PG-13 that goes down in a rating instead of more in a rating? Like, I was like, I would love for my daughter to be able to see this movie. And I was just like, I would love for a lot of little kids to see Prey. Like, there's something, if only it wasn't for all the crazy violence that I came up with.
the brutality and the gore.
It'd be a really awesome movie for those kids. And of course, I remember being furious when I was a kid and every movie I wanted to see was rated R and my parents wouldn't let me see it. And I was like mad at the movies. I was like, can't you just make one for me? Like, I want to see, can't you just do it for please? This is so annoying. I want to see this premise, this story. So that's all subconscious. But by putting Deck on this planet and the things that he's killing are creatures
and robots.
Just meant that we could do whatever. The same muscles and activators and mind grapes that, you know, work in Killer of Killers to come up with all the most insane over the top violence and Prey. The same decisions, the same choices, the same things. There's plenty of beheadings and chest burstings and spine rips and all of those things. It's just
robot
purple.
Blood is a get out of jail free card.
It really is. Yeah.
There's a little commentary on the anti-clanker sentiment in our society these days.
When we went screen for the MPAA, we did have to make some changes. We took out a little of the white blood and added a few more sparks, which is fine. One of the challenging parts was in the prep was like we had all this like, you know, graph of all the creatures in the movie. And it was okay. Special effects department comes, what color blood, you know? And it's like, well, it can't be green. That's Predator. And like, okay, this one will make this one. It's like, how many colors? This one's purple. This one's yellow. Now what? You know, like and it can't be red. None of it's red, you know? So like, that was really hard. Was coming up with fluid colors.
Why couldn't they all just
white was spoken for with
white sense. Couldn't do red, green, or white. So right. Why couldn't they all just be like roughly the same? Like,
they could have been, but you want to like feel
all
like
all the, you know, things have the same blood.
This
color.
Creature, it's true. It's true. Yep. I brought that up, and some of them are. But we wanted to make it feel like iconically, like, oh, you know, this thing's being killed or that or what, you know, this is before the movie was set in stone and we were still like, some sequences were still being concocted and we didn't quite know. Wait, what was the, how did we get here? Oh, PG-13. So the thing about it on this topic that it would be great to say, cause I don't know that I've had a chance to say this. And I kept wanting to loudly, like so many, like the comment of Predator being Disney-fied, was said very early and stuck throughout the process. And the irony of it all.
Wait, it's said very early by who? Just who are you, like, what?
Internet commentators.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Vocal minority, probably, whatever. Yeah. But like, but anyone can imagine very easily that the bud came from like the marketing department of Disney. And but I would point out how few bud stuffed animals there are to everyone to
and it kills me.
And it kills me. But
I want a deck plushie. Yeah.
There's I know. There's some NECA stuff coming out soon, but there's no like, but anyway, but all of that is me trying to get Disney to make the, like Not even like they needed that to convince they. I mean, in terms of like that's what made them nervous was making Predator cute and legs and all that stuff was like maybe we shouldn't do this stuff and the bud thing was like maybe we shouldn't. I was the one saying this is going to be great. This is everyone can be mad at Dan. You know, like no one should be mad at Disney. No, none of this stuff came from Disney to do. PG-13 did not come from Disney. Like none of that. It was all like I had these crazy ideas, and I thought these would make the movie cooler. Not the other way around.
That sounds like a fun meeting, though. Like here in the house of Mickey Mouse, we have certain R-rated standards for our Predator. And you're like, no.
Well, sir. You know, it's 20. Yeah. It's 20th and Disney. Yeah, so it's, right. It's part of the conversations with 20th.
Yeah.
But Disney is also like, wait, we want the movie Predator fans to come to this movie. And they were very, that's why all the marketing very early on was like Predator, 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 much to my chagrin. I just thought these things would make the movie special.
Well, what do you mean much to your chagrin though, Dan? You're saying the early marketing emphasized the Predator component, but you would have done something else. What do you mean by that?
I think, I mean, it's all awesome and all the spots were really cool, but no, I even the title, even the, like, I think I lean towards, the movie should not rely so much on predator-ness because, in point A, just from a business standpoint, those movies have, outside of the first one, have had a real ceiling on the business that they can do.
Yes.
The movie, there's a lot of people that hear, no matter what, you know, like hear Predator movie and go, oh, I don't like those.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And the movie is nothing like those.
Right. Right.
So I was like, I want to make sure that a lot of people that might think the movie's not for them might find the movie out to be for them.
Yeah.
That's what's great about streaming now is there's less of a barrier. This was trying to get people to go to the theaters to see it. Now
so,
without
so
the
should
barrier.
The title have been Badlands, A Predator Tale, maybe?
There were lots of things like that. That may have been cool. But anyway, all to say is like it what the opposite of what you would think. And you know, I was ready to fall on that sword or raise it by the end.
Was your original conception that the title would be Badlands alone by itself with no Predator?
No, Badlands was a temp title. Mm. Badlands was because Prey had this temp title Skulls that I thought was terrible. because everyone people thought the movie was called Skull sounds like a there was that movie, you know, the with Pacey. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I'm saying it. Yeah. Rob Cohen directed. Yeah. Paul Walker.
The Skulls.
And it just sounds like a hard, cheap, kind of a cheap horror movie to me, Skulls. I thought, you know, but people thought that was the name of the movie for a long time. And I was like, I want to come up with, make sure next time around we have a really cool sounding temp title. And it
Let's
was time
Terrence
for me.
Malick for the
yeah,
next
Terrence
title.
Malick. Yeah.
You think Terrence Malick, but actually my Blizzard launcher was open, and a friend of ours, Reza, it tells you where someone's WoW character is, mm-hmm. and it said Azurkor is in Badlands, you know.
Wow.
And I was like, oh yeah, Badlands, that's cool.
Really goes it rings off the tongue.
Yeah. And so that was just the temp title, and for me to one day figure out what a better title could be.
How do you describe a cool place that is not good? Yes. Badlands.
I just like the idea that it was what happened to be in front of Dan at that moment.
Yeah, it was like Kobayashi.
It could have been Predator Azeroth.
Predator Overwatch.
P-tier Griffin.
Good stuff. Good stuff. I want to. We have to talk about the legs fight scene. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Incredible. Incredible in conception and execution. Again, only a madman could dream something like that up. Can you talk a little bit about the conception of that and how that came to be? And was it easier to do than you thought it was, harder to do? Like, what was it like to make the legs fight scene at the end of Predator Badlands?
It started with my collaboration with the Third Floor, the previous company that we did Killer of Killers with as an animated film, but they also do previs for these movies. And you can see on the disc, there was initially a big legs fight in the Callus Den, where the first time we fight all the synths was going to be halfway through the movie, and developed some really fun ideas. Once again, it's only in this movie, only with this character can we do a fight like this. So really want to take full advantage of that. So it started out there. Then that scene became, this is not on the disc, but then that scene, we started storyboarding, when it became a fight with the Kalisk. And I, inside that scene was going to be a moment where she was fighting a synth and the Kalisk was fighting Deck, and then she on the back of a synth grabs the gun to shoot at the Kalisk, and the Kalisk charges towards them, and then she slides down as the Kalisk munches the top half of the bad guy synth. So that idea, our stunt coordinator, awesome Jacob Tamori, took and then put when we moved the fight to the end, and then concocted several of his own awesome ideas. And we came up with that fight, and I shot it, I think, a little differently than we preconceived, and it made it much more aggressive visually. And Jacob came up with that beat at the end where the high five, the foot five, as a joke. He put the end of his stunt viz just to make us laugh. And then so many of those ideas that make you feel uncomfortable when you pitch them. And Jacob was like really nervous showing us that. And, you know, but those tend to be the like, wait, what if we really did that? You know,
what do you mean by make you feel uncomfortable? Can you just expand on that?
I have this all the time where like, and I'll sort of preface when I meet with actors in the beginning, before we shoot, like how much I want us to just try things, and how many bad ideas I will probably say to them, because usually the things that, even when if you right now were trying to come up with an idea for a movie, the first idea that will feel good, like a good movie to you, probably is because it exists already, you know? And it, so it feels comfortable. You're like, oh yeah, I know that, you know, like, yeah, I can see that it's a movie, you know, like, cause it's like, oh yeah. Then you like think for an hour later or the next day, you're like, oh, wait a second. I just refigured out Seven, you know? which I've had a million times. Just super disappointed, you know. I'm like, oh my god, wait a second. I thought I had a brilliant idea. That you know,
you just keep reliving Seven in your head.
Yeah, not just Seven, but whatever. But but so with creative ideas, you know, I think like if I have a thought for an actor to try this, and it's like weird and unprecedented, I get really self-conscious. Like she or he may laugh at me. When I say, hey, what if you tried it like at X? And they're like, what are you thinking? You know? but all of those, and that's an idea that I pitched. That was like, that was stalactites. That was whatever. You know, so all these things that everyone's like, okay. You know, like I have to push through it. Sometimes it's like, oh, no, I'm really glad, you know? And I'll say something to that in a second. But
you're really glad when someone pushes back on it, is what?
Oh
you
my
mean,
god! Yeah. Which I'll speak more on. Yeah. But like, you gotta pitch those things that feel weird, and you gotta like actually try. Even the idea in Cloverfield Lane, the mailbox. There's a shot at the end of the movie, and her car rams through a mailbox, and it says Cloverfield Lane. That was in a VFX meeting. Someone made a joke like, what if she just hit a because we didn't have the title, and we like announced the room like, oh, maybe has a title now, Cloverfield Lane. So I was like, what if she like hit a mailbox? And it was like, and we were all like, and then everyone sat for a second. I was like, wait, maybe we should do that. And then we were like, wait, rewind, like, okay, play that. Oh my God, we could put the mailbox right there. And then we could just, what if we just, the camera just pushed, like it was like, those are things that are exciting because they're new and they feel a little funny. And, that's the foot five. And that's the entire leg fight is like filled with, are people going to think this is silly? And there was a lot of anxiety over because that the Weyland-Yutani bits are associated with the Alien franchise, which is not really one to embrace humor and fun and all that stuff. So there was a lot of anxiety about that, and people, that could have been one of the things that people were like, what the heck is that? Like making fun of the movie. But in point of fact, it's actually people's favorite moment of the movie. So the thing I was going to say about pushing back was there was a moment, I had a few repeat crew members from Prey on Badlands. Prey turned out to be a successful movie. And there were plenty of times during Prey where, you know, had a lot of anxiety over pitching something and people were worried about it and second guess. And then I sometimes would cave, you know, and feel like, yeah, maybe they're right. And sometimes that was right. And sometimes that was wrong. But obviously people witnessed a lot of things that in the time, whether they even said it or not, were probably thinking, oh my God, this guy's not, you know, like this movie's, you know, not gonna, and they saw the movie and it worked and they ended up liking it. So now on Badlands, those I felt in the room, me pitching something ridiculous that I was more thinking this is probably a bad idea and wanting the justification to not think about it anymore. You know, I was sort of looking for that, and people going, oh yeah, you know, and like not saying anything,
right? And you'd already proven yourself.
Felt like, oh, this is cool. They trust me now in a different way. But also, you know, no bueno. Like, I need them, especially in that moment where I was, like, really looking to, like, I think this is, tell me this is bad so I can move on, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, no. And I had that in the smallest dose.
Yeah. But
that really brought to light our favorite filmmakers, our favorite actors, all those things who, it's not their fault. It's not the fault. Like, the system of it all.
Yeah.
Why would you ever, if you
tell George Lucas, that's
Lucas,
a bad idea.
Spielberg, Canyon, why would you ever say, if you just were with them through that process, and it feels the same now that it does in movie one to movie two, feels the same. Oh my God, I think this might be ridiculous. But I thought that last time and it was brilliant. You know? Yeah. How could you ever work up the courage to say something to that person?
Right.
How could you? It wouldn't make it it's beyond it's against human nature. So I get why things can end up in the places that they do, when sometimes films from certain filmmakers and future films don't live up, you know, to the quality of previous
work.
All
of a sudden you're watching Megalopolis.
Absolutely.
But I thought anyway.
That's cool.
I only have a couple of more questions left, so I want to make sure, Devinder and Jeff, anything else you want
to
ask?
I want to ask about Demetrius, like the freaking predator. How did you land on him? And also, as an actor, that is kind of a difficult role to, like, it's kind of thankless, because it's not even like The Mandalorian where, like, oh yeah, that's Pedro Pascal behind there sometimes. This is just like, this is a guy people have not seen before, but also he doesn't really get to stretch his own, like, talents. Like, he's kind of like a stunt double for this digital character sometimes. How did you land on him? And, like, were there any issues with him wanting to show himself, his own personality, through this character?
No, I've landed on him with a lot of exclamation points. When we saw footage we had a few actors and stuntmen doing a obstacle course to see how they moved. And it was like, this is the guy. Like, the way that he moved was so darn cool that I can't wait to see Predator that moves like that. It's because you can definitely feel too human. And I think there are some man in suit and Predator performances that you can, it feels like a professional wrestler, sort of, you can feel the guy in there. And you can also go too odd or too creature like, and it not feel like it's something with intelligence that's bipedal, and, you know, and then there's the specific characteristics of what Deck is as a character, that's got it. He's got a chip on his shoulder and something to prove, and a lot of angst, and just, but also is badass and is very, you know, and very capable in many ways, but not in every way. And so, what we were, Demetrius physically was just tremendous in honing in on all of those things, and was getting a lot of different kinds of input, but still just sort of did his thing, and it was awesome. Was not at all prepared for him to be giving such an emotional performance throughout, relentlessly, exhaustively, massively upsetting to see him sometimes dealing with, you know, loss in the beginning of the movie, but the catharsis of him, like, releasing it towards, you know, and the complicated stuff with him feeling betrayed, and all of it gave us chills, you know, watching him. I was like, oh my God, the movie gets to be this. I didn't think the movie could even be what it was. And was so bummed that we had to cover up his face. You know, he's a handsome guy too. You know, I was like, oh my God, and he's so charming and so cool. And so, yeah, it's a bummer that we had to cover all that stuff up. And it's one of the things, of all the challenges that you guys have brought up, it's like there's this other, it's not just that he has a CG face.
Mm-hmm.
It's that he also has no nose, no lips, and fangs, and, like, teeth that don't let the mouth close. And all the things, when you think of, from Planet of the Apes to Gollum, all the great CG performances, they're all humanoid faces. So we can see ourselves, see the emotion very clearly. And when language is used, we understand, you know, this, you know, pronunciation of things, like, we had to find our way through it all to translate what Demetrius was doing. And so there weren't a lot of performance moments where we changed what the Predator, what Deck's face was doing from what Demetrius was doing, and yet his performance, what the VFX artists had to do to figure out how to translate what Demetrius was doing took so much artistry and craft. And so it really was a beautiful collaboration between everyone to pull off what Deck is. But yeah, Demetrius was an incredible find, and I hope people continue to watch him in future stuff.
All right. Well, I think we can actually wrap it up there. But Dan, we are so grateful for your time today and sharing with us from your experiences. Dan Trachtenberg is the director of Predator Badlands, which is out right now on Disney Plus and Hulu. And it's also out on 4K Blu-ray, where Dan has alluded to many of the special features you can get when you buy the physical media. Support physical media, folks. It's really important. Dan, I do just want to offer you, you know, if you're ever looking for someone to say, that is a terrible idea, I think the people on this podcast can oblige. But Dan, thank you so much for chatting with us today, man. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Always fun to hang.